Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is Turning Towards Life. I am Lizzie, and this is the wonderful Justin. We are third space people, so you can see a little bit more of who we are by going to wearethirdspace.org or turningtowards.life, where all of these episodes are published, as well as all of the sources. And essentially, we are talking to you every week by having conversations between us, which is quite a strange way of talking to people, Justin, in the world, but it's our way of doing it. And so our conversation with each other is, as we know from all the feedback we've received, Justin, a very meaningful piece of people's lives, which I'm so amazed at and grateful for. So I just want to say how welcome you are here, everybody, as you're listening or watching us. And we are here with a wonderful source chosen by you, Justin. So we alternate the choice of source each week, and we carefully wonder what kind of sources we should be bringing here every time. And of course, Maya Stein is one of our loveliest, well, she feels like my friend anyway. I've never met her, but I read her poetry all the time, and I feel in receipt of her goodness and her Mayan-ness. And every time we bring something, I think we brought something from her a couple of times in Turning Towards Life so far. And I feel a kind of kindredness between us. I'm really grateful that you've brought something this week from her. And we'll each read this and see where the conversation takes us, as we normally do each week.
Thank you, Lizzie. I loved your explanation of what we're doing and how we're doing it. That seems just right as an introduction. And I want to say welcome to everybody, too. Thank you for being with us. And say if you maybe you're very new to us, or maybe you've been with us for a while, and you might want to, as well as checking out the turningtowards.life website and the We Are Third Space website to see who we are and what we're up to, if you want to get us in your inbox or on your device, we're a podcast, and you can subscribe on all the, on all the podcast places like Spotify and Apple Podcasts and all of that. Just look for turningtowards.life, Turning Towards Life. And you can also get us by email every week. And there's a lovely button on our website that says sign up, and you'll get the conversation by email. And if you feel so moved, you can also support us. So we are very committed to this being very widely and freely available in the world. And sometimes people feel like you might feel like you want to reciprocate. So we have a very sweet and easy way to do that. If you want, you can go to our website and just click on the support us button there, and it'll tell you all about how you can join in being in relationship with us in that way if you wish. And we've had such lovely support and such beautiful messages from people as well. This It's been such a great joy, everybody. Every time someone's decided to buy us a cup of coffee or a bunch of cups of coffee and has written something about what Turning Towards Life means to them. So that's as much a part of it as anything else, is hearing from you. And you can email us at hello@turningtowards.life. Lots of ways to be in this conversation. And this source, which you can find in the notes to this episode and on the website and in the email, all those places, yes, is by Maya, who I have met, Lizzie, and spent some time with, and who really does feel like a kindred. Maya, you are a kindred spirit, a kindred soul to us. And Lizzie, Maya is one of those people who writes a lot of very, very excellent poetry, and I would have no trouble bringing Maya's work again and again and again and again. It would be a, there's one version of Turning Towards Life, which is sort of like the Maya Stein. We could just keep going, and there'd be so much to say on each one. And that's not what we do, because we're having a range of sources. But I wanted to say that. I want to say that to you, Maya. I suspect you may get a chance to listen to this to thank you for your work and your generosity and your keeping on goingness of pouring your heart and your mind and your wisdom and your generosity out into the world, so we can all benefit from it. So this source, what to do, what to love when you're running out of things to love. Lizzie, you and I have been talking about how in these months, October, November 2023, when we're recording these, and the world, the fire in the world seems to be is taking on new and difficult to deal with forms for so many of us. We found ourselves drawn to many kinds of source which bring us into the everyday possibility of loving and taking care of one another and taking care of the world that's right around us. And this is probably, I don't know, about the fifth week in a row that we've looked at lots and lots and lots of different possible sources and both found ourselves drawn this way. So maybe this is what we need. Maybe this is helpful. Maybe my guess is there'll be other people, others of you who need this too. What to love when you're running out of things to love? Pick any landscape. A kitchen counter, a waiting room. That part of your body you shield from photographs. And narrow the distance between you. At first, the stains will monopolize your eye. Each blight and crack and overgrowth, a seismic disruption. If you can bear the stillness of not looking away, if you step even closer, the contours will begin to lose their meaning. The noise of an old story will fade. New shapes will emerge like petals after a hard rain. I'm not saying you will desire suddenly the pits and pores of the world, or that your hands passing over every rough surface will feel fresh tenderness. But you'll notice your breathing has softened, your heart a door you can open past the jams. How there's room for what you see and everything you can't.
Often. What to love when you're running out of things to love? Pick any landscape, a kitchen counter, a waiting room, that part of your body you shield from photographs, and narrow the distance between you. At first, the stains will monopolize your eye. Each blight and crack and overgrowth, a seismic disruption. If you can bear the stillness of not looking away, if you step even closer, the contours will begin to lose their meaning. The noise of an old story will fade. New shapes will emerge, like petals after a hard rain. I'm not saying you will desire suddenly the pits and pores of the world, or that your hands passing over every rough surface will feel fresh tenderness. But you'll notice your breathing has softened, your heart a door. You can open past the jams. How there's room for what you see and everything you can't.
Thank you, Lizzie. I am so taken by the title of Maya's writing, What to Love When You're Running Out of Things to Love. I think maybe maybe with the turmoil and the pain and the seismicness of the world around us at the moment, one of the ways it can feel when we're assaulted by our own pain and other people's pain and the impossibleness of our responding and making the whole thing better ourselves. It's actually very easy to identify with or get flooded by the parts of us that are despairing and traumatized. And one of the dangers of this is that in the midst of all of that, by identifying with the parts of us that are despairing and traumatized, that we become a different kind of person in the world than we might otherwise be. And for me, the very idea is one of the reasons I love everything that follows in Maya's poem. And there's so much to talk about in the rest of it. But the very idea that we might run out of things to love in this world is feels to me like an affront. How could that be? And at the same time, I recognize in me and in my own experience those times when that's exactly how it feels. I cannot, I've run out of love. I've run out of what to direct my heart towards. There is only terror and despair and hopelessness and pain. And that could be on a world scale, you know, when we're just responding to the calamities of the world, which of course get brought to us very immediately. And it could be when we're responding to the calamities of people we love and the calamities, you know, the difficulties that are right here. And it could be, and this is one I often feel, it could be also right in the middle of the mundane. I have way more emails than I can respond to. I mean, really boring, right? I've got way more emails than I can respond to. I'm behind on all of them. People are waiting for me. I know that there are some people who are feeling frustrated and let down, and I wish I could get to them, but it's too much for me very often. And, you know. So even before I read any of Maya's very sage advice about what to do, and there's wonderful invitations in there, I'm finding that noticing that there is a thing called running out of things to love that is worth responding to and not just taking it at face value, like having a name for it, is incredibly helpful, which is, oh, I'm running out of things to love. That is not a way of being in the world, actually, that I want to stay in for very long. Do not want to be the kind of presence in the world that has run out of the capacity to love, that I've run out of them. Something, oh, something is called for. And of course, what Maya says is one way in to open the jams of, you know, open the door of our hearts past the jams. It would be easy to not notice. That's why I think I'm saying all of this. It would be easy to find, certainly myself, I'm sure this is true of other people, living in a world where I and then we have run out of love and we're not doing anything about it because we took it to be the, it's become like the water that we've swum in because we weren't paying attention. And I feel so called to pay attention to this just because Maya wrote that as the title of her poem.
You're drawing me just into the very last line as well of how there's room for what you see and everything you can't. And how, I mean, I just think this piece of writing is completely genius. Like what it does to me, and I'm sure many, many other people. It's so true that it's so easy to become. Minimized by what I can see habitually, and to forget there's a load of things that I can't see. And I feel like this invitation to the everything you can't see, and how Maya takes us there from the very beginning to the end of this. The noise of an old story will fade. It's like Maya knows that we live in stories. We know that we are, like, if you've ever experienced any kind of pattern in your life, Justin, as I have, it's like we know we're living in a story that creates the same happening again and again. And then at some point we go, hold on, that I'm part of this. There must be some part of me involved here in having the same thing, the same pattern emerge again and again. And so I guess that's how I relate to the room for what I can see. And to know that there's a world beyond all of that, always. And that's this invitation that I'm seeing and feeling from Maya here, is that there's something being missed out when I am only focusing on the catastrophe or the problems or the things I don't like or the complaints I have or the disruption or whatever. which are all important things to hold. Like they matter to us clearly, because otherwise we wouldn't be holding them in the story. But there's this way that to stop there doesn't feel like where we should stop. And that's what makes me really joyful in reading these words from Maya, is that it's like a big fat and going on, like a big, like, yes, to your experience of each blight and crack and overgrowth being a disruption. Yes, that's how most of us experience life. And there will be fresh tenderness too. And it feels so life-giving to me to admit that that it's just true that there's many brackets, probably most things I can't see and feel that are simultaneously happening, as well as the things that I'm focused on, that my patterns and my habits of internal perception and interpretation of the world have me look at and focus on. And so I'm feeling so grateful that Maya seems for me to be this kind of constant invitation to things that are not readily visible by our habitual patterned selves. And that's why she's such a gift to me.
I'm really appreciating your drawing attention, Lizzie, to this. Oh, I know I can't find it. I've got Maya's text in front of me and I can't find the bit that you read. I'm going to find it. Somehow it's eluding me. Oh, there it is. The noise of an old story will fade. That line right in the middle. It's right at the heart. That you're drawing attention to the role of stories, and you just said our patterned selves, our patterned responses. And it was occurring to me when you were talking that one way of looking at it is to look at that in a very individualistic way, which is a completely legitimate way to look at it. You know, how am I looking at the kitchen counter or the waiting room or the part of my body that I shield from photographs? What kind of story and relationship am I in with each of those that means that I don't come to that with a relationship of love. I'm coming with something else. And how might I love this line, how might I narrow the distance between me and that which I am standing in judgment over, or in I'm ignoring, or I don't want to see, or I treat as boring, or you know, whatever it is, what it is, the intimacy of narrowing the distance. So we've got our own stories, our own very personal and intimate stories about each of those. And I got thinking whilst you're talking about how our patterning is also born collectively. It's not just down. It's not just my own. It is my own patterning, how I choose, what I choose to draw close to, what I choose to judge, what I choose to feel tenderness towards, what I choose to bear, not looking away from all of that. And the world, our world is made of our collective stories, the ones in our families and in our cultures, and also the ones that are the patternings that were there before we were even born, and the ones that go back in time. And then there are the ones that go back right to the dawn of the patternings, that the habits of looking that come from being a living something, just the you know, the patterns that everything living shares. And then there are the uniquely human patterns that we have. And those are pretty hard to work with because they are very, very deep in the, you know, like the base level of our way of seeing, our way of making sense. But the ones that are closer in time, even if they're really big collective ones, even if they're the great sort of drifts of our society, are much more amenable. Obviously, the individual ones are perhaps the most amenable to our shifting and looking in a different way. But I was thinking, the reason I'm saying all of this is I was thinking about how we can collectively get into a kind of stupor of treating the world as if it were humdrum and ordinary and therefore uninteresting, because we collectively have made a decision that the world is humdrum and boring and uninteresting. And there are some very powerful stories in our culture that do that. For example, I mean, this is a big one that's on my mind at the moment, is the story that the only real thing is solid matter, and solid matter is devoid of all characteristics. It's all, you know, it's just stuff, and we're the ones who add all the meaning to it, and therefore there is no meaning, and therefore we have no meaning, and therefore it's all meaningless, and we might as well just fill ourselves up with daytime TV, which we were talking about before, or, you know, whatever it is. I can play my part in shifting the world towards a way of looking and participating and loving by noticing how I am caught up in the predominant stories and ways of looking of my time and choosing to do other. And I think that's why I'm so moved by Meyer's line, invitation to narrow the distance, because I think that many of us are in a culture which really privileges distance, like a sort of distance and a cynicism and a sort of judgment and a sort of certainty and a sort of, you know, there's all kinds of things that come with it. And when we get really close, I love this. I want to get close to the kitchen. Our kitchen counter needs a lot of attention. It's 25 years old. And despite my attempts to, you know, keep it in good shape, I failed miserably. And the water, where the water has come off the sink and the wood is all, you know, and sometimes I can look at it with all kinds of judgment and desperation that we should have a different kitchen counter or something. But I feel so moved to really get close to it and see it as the kitchen counter that has carried our family life through 25 years. The kitchen was put in before there were children in this family, right when we were first in the young stages of our relationship. And it is the way it is because of all of the washing up that's happened and all of the meals that have been made and all of the, you know, and all of the everything. If I'm prepared to narrow the distance between me and it, if I'm prepared to look upon it with loving eyes and bear the stillness of not looking away and let the old stories about it fade. So I think that what Maya's inviting us into is obviously very good for each of us, but I also think it's really revolutionary. Like if we would narrow the distance, and the more we can do this, each of us, the more we bring ourselves into intimacy with the world, which is the thing that I think that we've most given up on in the stories that we have in our cultures, intimacy with the world around us, the living and the non-living world. What a relief to be intimate with it. And also how much simpler life is in a way, because if I can be loving and close with our not in great shape kitchen counter and not have to be in a, well, you know, so-and-so's got a much nicer kitchen counter. If we had a much nicer kitchen counter, then if I can, so much of the desperation and longing, unresolved longing that I feel, it becomes superficial and irrelevant, because I choose to love when I'm otherwise running out.
Justin, as you're talking, it's reminding me of this wonderfully bonkers thing I did once, which I may have talked to you about already here, but that we were on like a kind of week-long silent retreat in this, it was an ashram in Tennessee, which sounds really bonkers, but it was that. And the task we got given was to go outside and be with a stone or a rock for something like 5 hours, I think it was. And I was literally like, seriously? I mean, so, you know, that kind of inner, this is crazy bonkers, but I've signed up to be here and I'm going to just have to participate because otherwise I have to leave and don't want to leave. I signed up to this for a reason, you know. And I still remember this stone that I made relationship with and what shape it is and what kind of contours and sharp pieces and angles it has on it and what kind of color and roughness. And it was this, it was like I had somehow narrowed the distance between me and this quite a small stone I picked out of this kind of pebbly driveway thing. And of course, whatever story I had about that stone, which was not particularly conscious in me, so it was an unconscious story, like as in, yes, I had a story about that stone, but I didn't know what it was until I looked at it and thought, this is a bit boring, and why am I here, and what's the point of me looking at a stone, and all of that stuff. And I faithfully kept on keeping on being in a relationship with a stone, and then it became so moving to me, this stone. And it really did change a lot. It really changed a lot, because it did this thing that Maya is saying, that at first the stains monopolized my eyes. I could see all its surface kind of imperfections, and why did I even choose this stone? It's just a boring old stone, and had lots of stuff going on about the stone. And just by paying attention, just by narrowing this distance, new shapes emerged, and something else arose, a kind of tenderness, where I can actually say to you, I know what it is to love a stone. Like I can actually say that in my experience. And I know it sounds bonkers to the part of me that was the one who hadn't loved a stone before. I completely understand that. But it's just true that there was a like proper tenderness for this stone, and it's lodged. This stone is lodged. It's still, in the world, and probably still in Tennessee, unless somebody picked it up and took it somewhere else. And something really, really big happened, which was that I could understand that there's room for what I can see and everything that I couldn't see. It showed itself to me, but I had to narrow the distance between me and it consciously in order for that to happen. And it was one of those experiences that was quite a big experience, which is not what I do every day. I don't sit staring at stones every day. But what it did is it put a kind of marker post out there for me of what's possible. And so it helped me see all the ways that I do participate in the narrative that you were talking about, of everything just being unmysterious and obvious. And now I really question that. And I look at leaves differently, and the shape of trees, and what a snowflake means, and shape of a fork, and the surface of a table. And even though I'm not immune to all of this narrowing and the old stories that I have and the habits that I have, somehow that experience gave me a kind of an outpost of reference point of, oh, you really don't see a lot of the time. Because if that can happen, and you can fall in love like that with an inanimate piece of nature, then what else is possible?
I'm thinking about a stone I have here, somewhere on the shelf below, that I felt very drawn to, and because I know where it came from and I know a bit of geology, I know enough about this stone to know that it predates humans by about 240 million years. It was already basically what it is now, then, and then it's traveled through time. And in hearing you talk about this encounter, loving encounter with a stone that you had, Lizzie, it reminds me that every stone has a story like that, every single one. We just don't know it. And maybe the great mistake that we make, that we all make, when you're saying you're not immune to the narrowness, and I was thinking, yeah, I'm not immune to the narrowness, none of us, that's the point. The point is that maybe it's one of those simple and such important things that we can do, is to unnarrow ourselves in the face of, like, our kitchen counter, which I seem very, in focus for me right now in this conversation, not only has a history as our kitchen counter, it's made of wood, which grew somewhere, that came from a seed that had a whole history of itself. And then that history goes back into the whole evolution of trees in the world and the role that trees have played and how they came to be trees all the way back. So we can, as you were talking about the stone, what I was feeling in myself, Lizzie, was, well, if we can, allow ourselves to love a stone, we can get really, intimate and loving with the world. And that also means we can get loving with one another. We stop treating one another as the annoying person who's, you know, ahead of me in the queue for the bus, or we let go of our judgments, as Maya says. The old stories will fade and new shapes will emerge like petals after a hard rain. Today, I actually can think of very few more important things that we do with our lives than notice our narrowing and find ways, like Maya is bringing us, of softening our breathing and being in relationship so that our hearts can open past the jams. Because the alternative is to live in the world of hardness and narrowing and certainty and judgment and distance. And it might feel safer to live that way. And we might be getting lots of encouragement to live that way, but that doesn't mean it's the way for us, what to dedicate ourselves to. It's more like we've put in the center the place that we get to when we've most forgotten ourselves, instead of putting in the center what would be much more life-giving, would much more have us be ourselves when if it were in the center.
Yeah. You're just pointing, Justin, for me, to just how much I can also do this for not the things in life, but the humans in life. You know how easy it is to make someone into, it's very, very limited something. And how, you know, we say this all the time, and I know this to be true, that each of us is these wonderful, mysterious magnitude of mystery. You know, each person is just an entire world. It's massive. It's just massive. And yet, my capacity to reduce people to something is quite something in itself. And this is like a renewal, I think, of the commitment to being open to that perception or interpretation of human beings being those magnitudinous worlds of unfathomability, and that we don't know anything. Well, we don't know what's going on, basically. We're these little teeny ones in amongst something much more massive. And this, what we can see, is like teeny tiny. And to know that there's so much that I can't see and I can't hold in my awareness and I can't understand even, it feels big, and I have to breathe myself bigger to accept that that's true. And as you say, it's so life-giving, and so much more can arrive with me. I can receive so much more because, of course, the aperture of me is bigger in that place than when I'm narrowing and only attending to the things that I can see. So I'm really grateful for this invitation and this recommitment to the softening of my heart that tells me there's way more than what I'm currently in relationship with, and I can rely on that being true all the time.
That is a wonderful place for us to end, Lizzie. So thank you to you, as always. I was just, in my mind, I was working out that by the time we've done this conversation, Lizzie, you and I have spent basically a full waking month of our lives just talking to one another like this. That's kind of where we're up to. What a joy it is to be in the midst of that kind of depth of commitment, of keeping on coming back and seeing one another and seeing life afresh. So thank you to you, and thank you as always to Maya. I was thinking whilst you were talking about how Maya often publishes on her Facebook page the most amazing photos of her cat and of the shoreline, I imagine near to where Maya lives. I don't know exactly. And every one of those photos is an invitation to love and afresh and to reduce the intimacy, to reduce the distance. That's how they show up for me. So thank you, Maya, for your generosity also in giving us permission to use your poems so generously. And we're going to finish here for today, and all being well, we will be back again here next time.
Thank you, Justin.
Bye, everyone.